were in play in Britain by 1831. Clamping down on popular demands and undertaking a coup against inclusive political institutions would also destroy these gains, and the elites opposing greater democratization and greater inclusiveness might find themselves among those losing their fortunes from this destruction. Another aspect of this positive feedback is that under inclusive economic and political institutions, controlling power became less central. In Austria-Hungary and in Russia, as we saw in Chapter 8, the monarchs and the aristocracy had much to lose from industrialization and reform. In contrast, in Britain at the beginning of the 19th century, thanks to the development of inclusive economic institutions, there was much less at stake. There were no serfs, relatively little coercion in the labor market, and few monopolies protected by entry barriers. Clinging to power was thus much less valuable for the British elite. The logic of the virtuous circle also meant that such repressive steps would be increasingly infeasible, again, because of the positive feedback between inclusive economic and political institutions. Inclusive economic institutions lead to a more equitable distribution of resources than extractive institutions. As such, they empower the citizens at large and thus create a more level playing field, even when it comes to the fight for power. This makes it more difficult for a small elite to crush the masses rather than to give in to their demands, or at least to some of them. The British inclusive institutions had also already unleashed the Industrial Revolution, and Britain was highly urbanized. Using repression against an urban, concentrated, and partially organized and empowered group of people would have been much harder than repressing a peasantry or dependent serfs. The virtuous circle thus brought the first Reform Act to Britain in 1832, but this was just the beginning. There was still a long road to travel toward real democracy, because in 1832, the elite had only offered what they thought they had to, and no more. The issue of parliamentary reform was taken up by the Chartist movement, whose People's Charter of 1838 included the clauses, "A vote for every man 21 years of age, of sound mind and not undergoing punishment for crime. The ballot, to protect the elector in the exercise of his vote. No property qualification for members of Parliament, thus enabling the constituencies to return the man of their choice, be he rich or poor. Payment of members, thus enabling an honest tradesman, working man, or other person to serve a constituency when taken from his business to attend to the interests of the country. Equal constituencies, securing the same amount of representation for the same number of electors, instead of allowing small constituencies to swamp the votes of large ones. Annual parliaments, thus presenting the most effectual check to bribery and intimidation, since though a constituency might be bought once in 7 years, even with the ballot, no purse could buy a constituency, under a system of universal suffrage, in each ensuing 12 month, and since members, when elected for a year only, would not be able to defy and betray their constituents as now. By the ballot, they meant the secret ballot and the end of open voting, which had facilitated the buying of votes and the coercion of voters. The Chartist movement organized a series of mass demonstrations, and throughout this period, Parliament continually discussed the potential for further reforms. Though the Chartists disintegrated after 1848, they were followed by the National Reform Union, founded in 1864, and the Reform League, which was founded in 1865. In July 1866, major pro-reform riots in Hyde Park brought reform right to the top of the political agenda once more. This pressure bore dividends in the form of the Second Reform Act of 1867, in which the total electorate was doubled and working-class voters became the majority in all urban constituencies. Shortly afterward, the secret ballot was introduced, and moves were made to eliminate corrupt electoral practices such as treating, essentially buying votes in exchange for which the voter received a treat, usually money, food, or alcohol. The electorate was doubled again by the Third Reform Act of 1884, when 60% of adult males were enfranchised. Following the First World War, the Representation of the People Act of 1918 gave the vote to all adult males over the age of 21, and to women over the age of 30 who were taxpayers or married to taxpayers. Ultimately, all women also received the vote on the same terms as men in 1928. The measures of 1918 were negotiated during the war and reflected a quid pro quo between the government and the working classes, who were needed to fight and produce munitions. The government may also have taken note of the radicalism of the Russian Revolution. Parallel with the gradual development of more inclusive political institutions was a movement toward even more inclusive economic institutions. One major consequence of the First Reform Act was the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846. As we saw in Chapter 7, the Corn Laws banned the imports of grains and cereals, keeping their prices high and ensuring lucrative profits for large landowners. The new parliamentarians from Manchester and Birmingham wanted cheap corn and low wages. They won, and the landed interests suffered a major defeat. The changes in the electorate and other dimensions of political institutions taking place during the course of the 19th century were followed by further reforms. In 1871, the Liberal Prime Minister Gladstone opened up the civil service to public examination, making it meritocratic, and thus continuing the process of political centralization and the building of state institutions that started during the Tudor period. Liberal and Tory governments during this period introduced a considerable amount of labor market legislation. For example, the Masters and Servants Acts, which allowed employers to use the law to reduce the mobility of their workers, was repealed, changing the nature of labor relations in favor of workers. During 1906 to 1914, the Liberal Party, under the leadership of H.H. Asquith and David Lloyd George, began to use the state to provide far more public services, including health and unemployment insurance, government-financed pensions, minimum wages, and a commitment to redistributive taxation. As a result of these fiscal changes, taxes as a proportion of national product more than doubled in the last three decades of the 19th century, and then doubled again in the first three decades of the 20th. The tax system also became more progressive, so that wealthier people bore a heavier burden. Meanwhile, the education system, which was previously either primarily for the elite, run by religious denominations, or required poor people to pay fees, was made more accessible to the masses. The Education Act of 1870 committed the government to the systematic provision of universal education for the first time. Education became free of charge in 1891. The school leaving age was set at 11 in 1893. In 1899, it was increased to 12, and special provisions for the children of needy families were introduced. As a result of these changes, the proportion of 10-year-olds enrolled in school, which stood at a disappointing 40% in 1870, increased to 100% in 1900. Finally, the Education Act of 1902 led to a large expansion in resources for schools and introduced the grammar schools, which subsequently became the foundation of secondary education in Britain. In fact, the British example, an illustration of the virtuous circle of inclusive institutions, provides an example of a gradual virtuous circle. The political changes were unmistakably toward more inclusive political institutions and were the result of demands from empowered masses, but they were also gradual. Every decade, another step, sometimes smaller, sometimes larger, was taken toward democracy. There was conflict over each step, and the outcome of each was contingent. But the virtuous circle created forces that reduced the stakes involved in clinging to power. It also spurred the rule of law, making it harder to use force against those who were demanding what these elites had themselves demanded from Stuart monarchs. It became less likely that this conflict would turn into an all-out revolution, and more likely that it would be resolved in favor of greater inclusiveness. There is great virtue in this sort of gradual change. It is less threatening to the elite than the wholesale overthrow of the system. Each step is small, and it makes sense to give in to a small demand rather than create a major showdown. This partly explains how the Corn Law was repealed without more serious conflict. By 1846, landowners could no longer control legislation in Parliament. This was an outcome of the First Reform Act. However, if in 1832 the expansion of the electorate, the reform of the rotten boroughs, and the repeal of the Corn Laws had all been on the table, landowners would have put up much more resistance. The fact that there were first limited political reforms and that repeal of the Corn Laws came on the agenda only later diffused conflict. Gradual change also prevented ventures into uncharted territories. A violent overthrow of the system means that something entirely new has to be built in place of what has been removed. This was the case with the French Revolution, when the first experiment with democracy led to the Terror, and then back to a monarchy twice before finally leading to the French Third Republic in 1870. It was the case in the Russian Revolution, where the desires of many for a more equal system than that of the Russian Empire led to a one-party dictatorship that was much more violent, bloody, and vicious than what it had replaced. Gradual reform was difficult in these societies precisely because they lacked pluralism and were highly extractive. It was the pluralism emerging from the Glorious Revolution and the rule of law that it introduced that made gradual change feasible and desirable in Britain. The conservative English commentator Edmund Burke, who steadfastly opposed the French Revolution, wrote in 1790, "It is with infinite caution that any man should venture upon pulling down an edifice, which has answered in any tolerable degree for ages the common purposes of society, or on building it up again without having models and patterns of approved utility before his eyes." Burke was wrong on the big picture. The French Revolution had replaced a rotten edifice and opened the way for inclusive institutions, not only in France, but throughout much of Western Europe. But Burke's caution was not entirely off the mark. The gradual process of British political reform, which had started in 1688 and would pick up pace 3 decades after Burke's death, would be more effective because its gradual nature made it more powerful, harder to resist, and ultimately more durable. Busting trusts. Inclusive institutions in the United States had their roots in the struggles in Virginia, Maryland, and the Carolinas during the colonial period. These institutions were reinforced by the Constitution of the United States, with its system of constraints and its separation of powers. But the Constitution did not mark the end of the development of inclusive institutions. Just as in Britain, these were strengthened by a process of positive feedback, based on the virtuous circle. By the middle of the 19th century, all white males, though not women or blacks, could vote in the United States. Economic institutions became more inclusive, for example with the passage of the Homestead Act in 1862, which made frontier land available to potential settlers rather than allocating these lands to political elites. But just as in Britain, challenges to inclusive institutions were never entirely absent. The end of the U.S. Civil War initiated a rapid spurt of economic growth in the North. As railways, industry, and commerce expanded, a few people made vast fortunes. Emboldened by their economic success, these men and their companies became increasingly unscrupulous. They were called the robber barons because of their hard-nosed business practices, aimed at consolidating monopolies and preventing any potential competitor from entering the market or doing business on an equal footing. One of the most notorious of these was Cornelius Vanderbilt, who famously remarked, "What do I care about the law? Ain't I got the power?" Another was John D. Rockefeller, who started the Standard Oil Company in 1870. He quickly eliminated rivals in Cleveland and attempted to monopolize the transportation and retailing of oil and oil products. By 1882, he had created a massive monopoly, in the language of the day, a trust. By 1890, Standard Oil controlled 88% of the refined oil flows in the United States, and Rockefeller became the world's first billionaire in 1916. Contemporary cartoons depict Standard Oil as an octopus wrapping itself around not just the oil industry, but also Capitol Hill. Almost as infamous was John Pierpont Morgan, the founder of the modern banking conglomerate J.P. Morgan, which later, after many mergers over decades, eventually became J.P. Morgan Chase. Along with Andrew Carnegie, Morgan founded the U.S. Steel Company in 1901, the first corporation with a capitalized value of more than $1 billion, and by far the largest steel corporation in the world. In the 1890s, large trusts began to emerge in nearly every sector of the economy, and many of them controlled more than 70% of the market in their sector. These included several household names, such as DuPont, Eastman Kodak, and International Harvester. Historically, the United States, at least the northern and midwestern United States, had relatively competitive markets and had been more egalitarian than other parts of the country, particularly the South. But during this period, competition gave way to monopoly, and wealth inequality rapidly increased. The pluralistic U.S. political system already empowered a broad segment of society that could stand up against such encroachments. Those who were the victims of the monopolistic practices of the robber barons, or who objected to their unscrupulous domination of their industries, began to organize against them. They formed the populist, and then subsequently the progressive movements. The populist movement emerged out of a long-running agrarian crisis, which afflicted the Midwest from the late 1860s onward. The National Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry, known as the Grangers, was founded in 1867 and began to mobilize farmers against unfair and discriminatory business practices. In 1873 and 1874, the Grangers won control of 11 Midwestern state legislatures, and rural discontent culminated in the formation of the People's Party in 1892, which got 8.5% of the popular vote in the 1892 presidential election. In the next two elections, the populists fell in behind the two unsuccessful Democratic campaigns by William Jennings Bryan, who made many of their issues his own. Grassroots opposition to the spread of the trusts had now organized to try to counteract the influence that Rockefeller and other robber barons were exerting over national politics. These political movements slowly began to have an impact on political attitudes and then on legislation, particularly concerning the role of the state in the regulation of monopoly. The first important piece of legislation was the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, which created the Interstate Commerce Commission and initiated the development of the federal regulation of industry. This was quickly followed by the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. The Sherman Act, which is still a major part of U.S. antitrust regulation, would become the basis for attacks on the robber barons' trusts. Major action against the trusts came only after the election of presidents committed to reform and to limiting the power of the robber barons: Theodore Roosevelt, 1901 to 1909, William Taft, 1909 to 1913, and Woodrow Wilson, 1913 to 1921. A key political force behind antitrust and the move to impose federal regulation of industry was again the farm vote. Early attempts by individual states in the 1870s to regulate railroads came from farmers' organizations. Indeed, nearly all the 59 petitions that concerned trusts sent to Congress prior to the enactment of the Sherman Act came from farming states and emanated from organizations such as the Farmers Union, Farmers Alliance, Farmers Mutual Benefit Association, and patrons of animal husbandry. Farmers found a collective interest in opposing the monopolistic practices of industry. From the ashes of the populists, who seriously declined after throwing their weight behind the Democrats, came the progressives, a heterogeneous reform movement concerned with many of the same issues. The progressive movement initially gelled around the figure of Teddy Roosevelt, who was William McKinley's vice president and who assumed the presidency following McKinley's assassination in 1901. Prior to his rise to national office, Roosevelt had been an uncompromising governor of New York and had worked hard to eliminate political corruption and machine politics. In his first address to Congress, Roosevelt turned his attention to the trusts. He argued that the prosperity of the United States was based on market economy and the ingenuity of businessmen. But at the same time, there are real and grave evils and a widespread conviction in the minds of the American people that the great corporations known as trusts are in certain of their features and tendencies hurtful to the general welfare. This springs from no spirit of envy or uncharitableness, nor lack of pride in the great industrial achievements that have placed this country at the head of the nations struggling for commercial supremacy. It does not rest upon a lack of intelligent appreciation of the necessity of meeting, changing and changed conditions of trade with new methods, nor upon ignorance of the fact that combination of capital in the effort to accomplish great things is necessary when the world's progress demands that great things be done. It is based upon sincere conviction that combination and concentration should be not prohibited, but supervised and within reasonable limits controlled. And in my judgment, this conviction is right. He continued, "It should be as much the aim of those who seek for social betterment to rid the business world of crimes of cunning as to rid the entire body politic of crimes of violence." His conclusion was that, "In the interest of the whole people, the nation should, without interfering with the power of the states in the matter itself, also assume power of supervision and regulation over all corporations doing an interstate business. This is especially true where the corporation derives a portion of its wealth from the existence of some monopolistic element or tendency in its business." Roosevelt proposed that Congress establish a federal agency with power to investigate the affairs of the great corporations, and that, if necessary, a constitutional amendment could be used to create such an agency. By 1902, Roosevelt had used the Sherman Act to break up the Northern Securities Company, affecting the interests of J.P. Morgan, and subsequent suits had been brought against DuPont, the American Tobacco Company, and the Standard Oil Company. Roosevelt strengthened the Interstate Commerce Act with the Hepburn Act of 1906, which increased the powers of the Interstate Commerce Commission, particularly allowing it to inspect the financial accounts of railways and extending its authority into new spheres. Roosevelt's successor, William Taft, prosecuted trusts even more assiduously, the high point of this being the breakup of the Standard Oil Company in 1910. Taft also promoted other important reforms, such as the introduction of a federal income tax, which came with the ratification of the 16th Amendment in 1913. The apogee of progressive reforms came with the election of Woodrow Wilson in 1912. Wilson noted in his 1913 book, The New Freedom, "If monopoly persists, monopoly will always sit at the helm of government. I do not expect to see monopoly restrain itself. If there are men in this country big enough to own the government of the United States, they are going to own it." Wilson worked to pass the Clayton Antitrust Act in 1914, strengthening the Sherman Act, and he created the Federal Trade Commission, which enforced the Clayton Act. In addition, under the impetus of the investigation of the Pujol Committee, led by Louisiana Congressman Arsène Pujol, into the money trust, the spread of monopoly into the financial industry, Wilson moved to increase regulation of the financial sector. In 1913, he created the Federal Reserve Board, which would regulate monopolistic activities in the financial sector. The rise of robber barons and their monopoly trusts in the late 19th and early 20th centuries underscores that, as we already emphasized in Chapter 3, the presence of markets is not by itself a guarantee of inclusive institutions. Markets can be dominated by a few firms, charging exorbitant prices and blocking the entry of more efficient rivals and new technologies. Markets, left to their own devices, can cease to be inclusive, becoming increasingly dominated by the economically and politically powerful. Inclusive economic institutions require not just markets, but inclusive markets that create a level playing field and economic opportunities for the majority of the people. Widespread monopoly, backed by the political power of the elite, contradicts this. But the reaction to the monopoly trusts also illustrates that when political institutions are inclusive, they create a countervailing force against movements away from inclusive markets. This is the virtuous circle in action. Inclusive economic institutions provide foundations upon which inclusive political institutions can flourish, while inclusive political institutions restrict deviations away from inclusive economic institutions. Trust busting in the United States, in contrast to what we have seen in Mexico, illustrates this facet of the virtuous circle. While there is no political body in Mexico restricting Carlos Slim's monopoly, the Sherman and Clayton Acts have been used repeatedly in the United States over the past century to restrict trusts, monopolies, and cartels, and to ensure that markets remain inclusive. The U.S. experience in the first half of the 20th century also emphasizes the important role of free media in empowering broad segments of society and thus in the virtuous circle. In 1906, Roosevelt coined the term muckraker, based on a literary character, the man with the muckrake in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, to describe what he regarded as intrusive journalism. The term stuck and came to symbolize journalists who were intrusively, but also effectively, exposing the excesses of robber barons as well as corruption in local and federal politics. Perhaps the most famous muckraker was Ida Tarbell, whose 1904 book, History of the Standard Oil Company, played a key role in moving public opinion against Rockefeller and his business interests, culminating in the breakup of Standard Oil in 1910. Another key muckraker was lawyer and author Louis Brandeis, who would later be named Supreme Court Justice by President Wilson. Brandeis outlined a series of financial scandals in his book, Other People's Money and How Bankers Use It, and was highly influential on the Pujol Committee. The newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst also played a salient role as muckraker. His serialization in his magazine, The Cosmopolitan, in 1906, of articles by David Graham Phillips, called The Treason of the Senate, galvanized the campaign to introduce direct elections for the Senate, another key progressive reform that happened with the enactment of the 17th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in 1913. The muckrakers played a major role in inducing politicians to take action against the trusts. The robber barons hated the muckrakers, but the political institutions of the United States made it impossible for them to stamp out and silence them. Inclusive political institutions allows free media to flourish, and a free media, in turn, make it more likely that threats against inclusive economic and political institutions will be widely known and resisted. In contrast, such freedom is impossible under extractive political institutions, under absolutism, or under dictatorships, which helps extractive regimes to prevent serious opposition from forming in the first place. The information that free media provided was clearly key during the first half of the 20th century in the United States. Without this information, the U.S. public would not have known the true extent of the power and abuses of the robber barons, and would not have mobilized against their trusts. Packing the Court. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Democratic Party candidate and cousin of Teddy Roosevelt, was elected president in 1932 in the midst of the Great Depression. He came to power with a popular mandate to implement an ambitious set of policies for combating the Great Depression. At the time of his inauguration in early 1933, one quarter of the labor force was unemployed, with many thrown into poverty. Industrial production had fallen by over half since the Depression hit in 1929, and investment had collapsed. The policies Roosevelt proposed to counteract this situation were collectively known as the New Deal. Roosevelt had won a solid victory, with 57% of the popular vote, and the Democratic Party had majorities in both the Congress and Senate, enough to pass New Deal legislation. However, some of the legislation raised constitutional issues and ended up in the Supreme Court, where Roosevelt's electoral mandate cut much less ice. One of the key pillars of the New Deal was the National Industrial Recovery Act. Title I focused on industrial recovery. President Roosevelt and his team believed that restraining industrial competition, giving workers greater rights to form trade unions, and regulating working standards were crucial to the recovery effort. Title II established the Public Works Administration, whose infrastructure projects include such landmarks as the 30th Street Railroad Station in Philadelphia, the Triborough Bridge, the Grand Coulee Dam, and the Overseas Highway connecting Key West, Florida with the mainland. President Roosevelt signed the bill into law on June 16, 1933, and the National Industrial Recovery Act was put into operation. However, it immediately faced challenges in the courts. On May 27, 1935, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that Title I of the Act was unconstitutional. Their verdict noted solemnly, "Extraordinary conditions may call for extraordinary remedies, but extraordinary conditions do not create or enlarge constitutional power." Before the court's ruling came in, Roosevelt had moved to the next step of his agenda and had signed the Social Security Act, which introduced the modern welfare state into the United States. Pensions at retirement, unemployment benefits, aid to families with dependent children, and some public health care and disability benefits. He also signed the National Labor Relations Act, which further strengthened the rights of workers to organize unions, engage in collective bargaining, and conduct strikes against their employers. These measures also faced challenges in the Supreme Court. As these were making their way through the judiciary, Roosevelt was reelected in 1936 with a strong mandate, receiving 61% of the popular vote. With his popularity at record highs, Roosevelt had no intention of letting the Supreme Court derail more of his policy agenda. He laid out his plans in one of his regular fireside chats, which was broadcast live on the radio on March 9, 1937. He started by pointing out that in his first term, much-needed policies had only cleared the Supreme Court by a whisker. He went on, "I am reminded of that evening in March, 4 years ago, when I made my first radio report to you. We were then in the midst of the great banking crisis. Soon after, with the authority of the Congress, we asked the nation to turn over all of its privately held gold, dollar for dollar, to the government of the United States. Today's recovery proves how right that policy was. But when almost 2 years later it came before the Supreme Court, its constitutionality was upheld only by a 5-4 vote. The change of one vote would have thrown all the affairs of this great nation back into hopeless chaos. In effect, four justices ruled that the right under a private contract to exact a pound of flesh was more sacred than the main objectives of the Constitution to establish an enduring nation. Obviously, this should not be risked again," Roosevelt continued. "Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, the Executive, and the courts. Two of the horses, the Congress and the Executive, are pulling in unison today. The third is not." Roosevelt then pointed out that the U.S. Constitution had not actually endowed the Supreme Court with the right to challenge the constitutionality of legislation, but that it had assumed this role in 1803. At the time, Justice Bushrod Washington had stipulated that the Supreme Court should presume in favor of a law's validity until its violation of the Constitution is proved beyond all reasonable doubt. Roosevelt then charged, "In the last 4 years, the sound rule of giving statutes the benefit of all reasonable doubt has been cast aside. The court has been acting not as a judicial body, but as a policy-making body." Roosevelt claimed that he had an electoral mandate to change this situation, and that, "After consideration of what reform to propose, the only method which was clearly constitutional was to infuse new blood into all our courts." He also argued that the Supreme Court judges were overworked, and the load was just too much for the older justices, who happened to be the ones striking down his legislation. He then proposed that all judges should face compulsory retirement at the age of 70, and that he should be allowed to appoint up to 6 new justices. This plan, which Roosevelt presented as the Judiciary Reorganization Bill, would have sufficed to remove the justices who had been appointed earlier by more conservative administrations and who had most strenuously opposed the New Deal. Though Roosevelt skillfully tried to win popular support for the measure, opinion polls suggested that only about 40% of the population was in favor of the plan. Louis Brandeis was now a Supreme Court justice. Though Brandeis sympathized with much of Roosevelt's legislation, he spoke against the president's attempts to erode the power of the Supreme Court and his allegations that the justices were overworked. Roosevelt's Democratic Party had large majorities in both houses of Congress, but the House of Representatives more or less refused to deal with Roosevelt's bill. Roosevelt then tried the Senate. The bill was sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which then held highly contentious meetings, soliciting various opinions on the bill. They ultimately sent it back to the Senate floor with a negative report, arguing that the bill was a needless, futile, and utterly dangerous abandonment of constitutional principle without precedent or justification. The Senate voted 70-20 to send it back to committee to be rewritten. all the court-packing elements were stripped away. Roosevelt would be unable to remove the constraints placed on his power by the Supreme Court. Even though Roosevelt's powers remained constrained, there were compromises, and the Social Security and the National Labor Relations Acts were both ruled constitutional by the court. More important than the fate of these two acts was the general lesson from this episode. Inclusive political institutions not only check major deviations from inclusive economic institutions, but they also resist attempts to undermine their own continuation. It was in the immediate interests of the Democratic Congress and Senate to pack the court and ensure that all New Deal legislation survived. But in the same way that British political elites in the early 18th century understood that suspending the rule of law would endanger the gains they had wrested from the monarchy, congressmen and senators understood that if the president could undermine the independence of the judiciary, then this would undermine the balance of power in the system that protected them from the president and ensured the continuity of pluralistic political institutions. Perhaps Roosevelt would have decided next that obtaining legislative majorities took too much compromise and time, and that he would instead rule by decree, totally undermining pluralism and the U.S. political system. Congress certainly would not have approved this, but then Roosevelt could have appealed to the nation, asserting that Congress was impeding the necessary measures to fight the Depression. He could have used the police to close Congress. Sound far-fetched? This is exactly what happened in Peru and Venezuela in the 1990s. Presidents Fujimori and Chavez appealed to their popular mandate to close uncooperative Congresses and subsequently rewrote their constitutions to massively strengthen the powers of the president. The fear of this slippery slope by those sharing power under pluralistic political institutions is exactly what stopped Walpole from fixing British courts in the 1720s, and it is what stopped the U.S. Congress from backing Roosevelt's court-packing plan. Roosevelt had encountered the power of virtuous circles. But this logic does not always play out, particularly in societies that may have some inclusive features but that are broadly extractive. We have already seen these dynamics in Rome and Venice. Another illustration comes from comparing Roosevelt's failed attempt to pack the court with similar efforts in Argentina, where crucially the same struggles took place in the context of predominantly extractive economic and political institutions. The 1853 Constitution of Argentina created a Supreme Court with duties similar to those of the U.S. Supreme Court. An 1887 decision allowed the Argentine court to assume the same role as that of the U.S. Supreme Court in deciding whether specific laws were constitutional. In theory, the Supreme Court could have developed as one of the important elements of inclusive political institutions in Argentina, but the rest of the political and economic system remained highly extractive, and there was neither empowerment of broad segments of society nor pluralism in Argentina. As in the United States, the constitutional role of the Supreme Court would also be challenged in Argentina. In 1946, Juan Domingo Perón was democratically elected president of Argentina. Perón was a former colonel and had first come to national prominence after a military coup in 1943, which had appointed him Minister of Labor. In this post, he built a political coalition with trade unions and the labor movement, which would be crucial for his presidential bid. Shortly after Perón's victory, his supporters in the Chamber of Deputies proposed the impeachment of four of the five members of the court. The charges leveled against the court were several. One involved unconstitutionally accepting the legality of two military regimes in 1930 and 1943. Rather ironic, since Perón had played a key role in the latter coup. The other focused on legislation that the court had struck down, just as its U.S. counterpart had done. In particular, just prior to Perón's election as president, the court had issued a decision ruling that Perón's new National Labor Relations Board was unconstitutional. Just as Roosevelt heavily criticized the Supreme Court in his 1936 re-election campaign, Perón did the same in his 1946 campaign. 9 months after initiating the impeachment process, the Chamber of Deputies impeached three of the judges, the fourth having already resigned. The Senate approved the motion. Perón then appointed four new justices. The undermining of the court clearly had the effect of freeing Perón from political constraints. He could now exercise unchecked power, in much the same way the military regimes in Argentina did before and after his presidency. His newly appointed judges, for example, ruled as constitutional the conviction of Ricardo Balbín, the leader of the main opposition party to Perón, the Radical Party, for disrespecting Perón. Perón could effectively rule as a dictator. Since Perón successfully packed the court, it has become the norm in Argentina for any new president to handpick his own Supreme Court justices. So a political institution that might have exercised some constraints on the power of the executive is gone. Perón's regime was removed from power by another coup in 1955 and was followed by a long sequence of transitions between military and civilian rule. Both new military and civilian regimes picked their own justices. But picking Supreme Court justices in Argentina was not an activity confined to transitions between military and civilian rule. In 1990, Argentina finally experienced a transition between democratically elected governments, one democratic government followed by another. Yet by this time, democratic governments did not behave much differently from military ones when it came to the Supreme Court. The incoming president was Carlos Saúl Menem of the Peronist Party. The sitting Supreme Court had been appointed after the transition to democracy in 1983 by the Radical Party president Raúl Alfonsín. Since this was a democratic transition, there should have been no reason for Menem to appoint his own court. But in the run-up to the election, Menem had already shown his colors. He continually, though not successfully, tried to encourage, or even intimidate, members of the court to resign. He famously offered Justice Carlos Fate an ambassadorship, but he was rebuked, and Fate responded by sending him a copy of his book, Law and Ethics, with the note, "Beware, I wrote this," inscribed. Undeterred, within 3 months of taking office, Menem sent a law to the Chamber of Deputies proposing to expand the court from 5 to 9 members. One argument was the same Roosevelt used in 1937. The court was overworked. The law quickly passed the Senate and chamber, and this allowed Menem to name 4 new judges. He had his majority. Menem's victory against the Supreme Court set in motion the type of slippery slope dynamics we mentioned earlier. His next step was to rewrite the Constitution to remove the term limit so he could run for president again. After being reelected, Menem moved to rewrite the Constitution again, but was stopped not by Argentina political institutions, but by factions within his own Peronist party, who fought back against his personal domination. Since independence, Argentina has suffered from most of the institutional problems that have plagued Latin America. It has been trapped in a vicious, not a virtuous, circle. As a consequence, positive developments such as first steps toward the creation of an independent Supreme Court never gained a foothold. With pluralism, no group wants or dares to overthrow the power of another, for fear that its own power will be subsequently challenged. At the same time, the broad distribution of power makes such an overthrow difficult. A Supreme Court can have power if it receives significant support from broad segments of society willing to push back attempts to vitiate the court's independence. That has been the case in the United States, but not Argentina. Legislators there were happy to undermine the court, even if they anticipated that this could jeopardize their own position. One reason is that with extractive institutions, there is much to gain from overthrowing the Supreme Court, and the potential benefits are worth the risks. Positive feedback and virtuous circles. Inclusive economic and political institutions do not emerge by themselves. They are often the outcome of significant conflict between elites resisting economic growth and political change, and those wishing to limit the economic and political power of existing elites. Inclusive institutions emerge during critical junctures, such as during the Glorious Revolution in England, or the foundation of the Jamestown Colony in North America, when a series of factors weaken the hold of the elites in power, make their opponents stronger, and create incentives for the formation of a pluralistic society. The outcome of political conflict is never certain, and even if in hindsight we see many historical events as inevitable, the path of history is contingent. Nevertheless, once in place, inclusive economic and political institutions tend to create a virtuous circle, a process of positive feedback, making it more likely that these institutions will persist and even expand. The virtuous circle works through several mechanisms. First, the logic of pluralistic political institutions makes usurpation of power by a dictator, a faction within the government, or even a well-meaning president much more difficult, as Franklin Roosevelt discovered when he tried to remove the checks on his power imposed by the Supreme Court, and as Sir Robert Walpole discovered when he attempted to summarily implement the Black Act. In both cases, concentrating power further in the hands of an individual or a narrow group would have started undermining the foundations of pluralistic political institutions, and the true measure of pluralism is precisely its ability to resist such attempts. Pluralism also enshrines the notion of the rule of law, the principle that laws should be applied equally to everybody, something that is naturally impossible under an absolutist monarchy. But the rule of law, in turn, implies that laws cannot simply be used by one group to encroach upon the rights of another. What's more, the principle of the rule of law opens the door for greater participation in the political process and greater inclusivity, as it powerfully introduces the idea that people should be equal not only before the law, but also in the political system. This was one of the principles that made it difficult for the British political system to resist the forceful calls for greater democracy throughout the 19th century, opening the way to the gradual extension of the franchise to all adults. Second, as we have seen several times before, inclusive political institutions support and are supported by inclusive economic institutions. This creates another mechanism of the virtuous circle. Inclusive economic institutions remove the most egregious extractive economic relations, such as slavery and serfdom, reduce the importance of monopolies, and create a dynamic economy, all of which reduces the economic benefits that one can secure, at least in the short run, by usurping political power. Because economic institutions had already become sufficiently inclusive in Britain by the 18th century, the elite had less to gain by clinging to power, and in fact, much to lose by using widespread repression against those demanding greater democracy. This facet of the virtuous circle made the gradual march of democracy in 19th century Britain both less threatening to the elite and more likely to succeed. This contrasts with the situation in absolutist regimes such as the Austro-Hungarian or Russian empires, where economic institutions were still highly extractive, and in consequence, where calls for greater political inclusion later in the 19th century would be met by repression because the elite had too much to lose from sharing power. Finally, inclusive political institutions allow free media to flourish, and free media often provide information about and mobilize opposition to threats against inclusive institutions, as they did during the last quarter of the 19th century and first quarter of the 20th century, when the increasing economic domination of the robber barons was threatening the essence of inclusive economic institutions in the United States. Though the outcome of the ever-present conflicts continues to be contingent, through these mechanisms, the virtuous circle creates a powerful tendency for inclusive institutions to persist, to resist challenges, and to expand as they did in both Britain and the United States. Unfortunately, as we will see in the next chapter, extractive institutions create equally strong forces toward their persistence, the process of the vicious circle. Chapter 12. The Vicious Circle. You can't take the train to Bow anymore. All of the West African nation of Sierra Leone became a British colony in 1896. The capital city, Freetown, had originally been founded in the late 18th century as a home for repatriated and freed slaves. But when Freetown became a British colony, the interior of Sierra Leone was still made up of many small African kingdoms. Gradually, in the second half of the 19th century, the British extended their rule into the interior through a long series of treaties with African rulers. On August 31, 1896, the British government declared the colony a protectorate on the basis of these treaties. The British identified important rulers and gave them a new title, Paramount Chief. In eastern Sierra Leone, for example, in the modern diamond mining district of Kono, they encountered Suluku, a powerful warrior king. King Suluku was made Paramount Chief Suluku, and the chieftaincy of Sandor was created as an administrative unit in the protectorate. Though kings such as Suluku had signed treaties with a British administrator, they had not understood that these treaties would be interpreted as carte blanche to set up a colony. When the British tried to levy a hut tax, a tax of 5 shillings to be raised from every house, in January 1898, the chiefs rose up in a civil war that became known as the Hut Tax Rebellion. It started in the north, but was strongest and lasted longer in the south, particularly in Mendaland, dominated by the Menda ethnic group. The Hut Tax Rebellion was soon defeated, but it warned the British about the challenges of controlling the Sierra Leonean hinterland. The British had already started to build a railway from Freetown into the interior. Work began in March 1896, and the line reached Songo Town in December 1898, in the midst of the Hut Tax Rebellion. British parliamentary papers from 1904 recorded that, in the case of the Sierra Leone railways, the native insurrection that broke out in February 1898 had the effect of completely stopping the works and disorganizing the staff for some time. The rebels descended upon the railway, with the result that the entire staff had to be withdrawn to Freetown. Rotafunk, now situated upon the railways at 55 miles from Freetown, was at that time completely in the hands of the rebels. In fact, Rotafunk was not on the planned railway line in 1894. The route was changed after the start of the rebellion, so that instead of going to the northeast, it went south, via Rotafunk and on to Bow, into Mendaland. The British wanted quick access to Mendaland, the heart of the rebellion, and to other potentially disruptive parts of the hinterland if other rebellions were to flare up. When Sierra Leone became independent in 1961, the British handed power to Sir Milton Margai and his Sierra Leone People's Party, SLPP, which attracted support primarily in the south, particularly Mendaland, and the east. Sir Milton was followed as Prime Minister by his brother, Sir Albert Margai, in 1964. In 1967, the SLPP narrowly lost a hotly contested election to the opposition. The All People's Congress Party, APC, led by Shaka Stevens. Stevens was a Limba from the north, and the APC got most of their support from northern ethnic groups, the Limba, the Temne, and the Loko. Though the railway to the south was initially designed by the British to rule Sierra Leone, by 1967 its role was economic, transporting most of the country's exports, coffee, cocoa, and diamonds. The farmers who grew coffee and cocoa were Mende, and the railroad was Mendaland's window to the world. Mendaland had voted hugely for Albert Margai in the 1967 election. Stevens was much more interested in holding on to power than promoting Mendaland's exports. His reasoning was simple. Whatever was good for the Mende was good for the SLPP and bad for Stevens. So he pulled up the railway line to Mendaland. He then went ahead and sold off the track and rolling stock to make the change as irreversible as possible. Now, as you drive out of Freetown to the east, you pass the dilapidated railway stations of Hastings and Waterloo. There are no more trains to Bow. Of course, Stevens's drastic action fatally damaged some of the most vibrant sectors of Sierra Leone's economy. But like many of Africa's post-independence leaders, when the choice was between consolidating power and encouraging economic growth, Stevens chose consolidating his power, and he never looked back. Today, you can't take the train to Bow anymore, because like Tsar Nicholas I, who feared that the railways would bring revolution to Russia, Stevens believed the railways would strengthen his opponents. Like so many other rulers in control of extractive institutions, he was afraid of challenges to his political power and was willing to sacrifice economic growth to thwart those challenges. Stevens's strategy, at first glance, contrasts with that of the British. But in fact, there was a significant amount of continuity between British rule and Stevens's regime that illustrates the logic of vicious circles. Stevens ruled Sierra Leone by extracting resources from its people using similar methods. He was still in power in 1985, not because he had been popularly re-elected, but because after 1967, he set up a violent dictatorship, killing and harassing his political opponents, particularly the members of the SLPP. He made himself president in 1971, and after 1978, Sierra Leone had only one political party, Stevens APC. Stevens thus successfully consolidated his power, even if the cost was impoverishing much of the hinterland. During the colonial period, the British used a system of indirect rule to govern Sierra Leone, as they did with most of their African colonies. At the base of this system were the paramount chiefs, who collected taxes, distributed justice, and kept order. The British dealt with the cocoa and coffee farmers, not by isolating them, but by forcing them to sell all their produce to a marketing board developed by the colonial office, purportedly to help the farmers. Prices for agricultural commodities fluctuated wildly over time. Cocoa prices might be high one year, but low the next. The incomes of farmers fluctuated in tandem. The justification for marketing boards was that they, not the farmers, would absorb the price fluctuations. When world prices were high, the board would pay the farmers in Sierra Leone less than the world price. But when the world prices were low, they would do the opposite. It seemed a good idea in principle. The reality was very different, however. The Sierra Leone Produce Marketing Board was set up in 1949. Of course, the board needed a source of revenues to function. The natural way to attain these was by paying farmers just a little less than they should have received, either in good or bad years. These funds could then be used for overhead expenditures and administration. Soon, the little less became a lot less. The colonial state was using the marketing board as a way of heavily taxing farmers. Many expected the worst practices of colonial rule in sub-Saharan Africa to stop after independence, and the use of marketing boards to excessively tax farmers to come to an end. But neither happened. In fact, the extraction of farmers using marketing boards got much worse. By the mid-1960s, the farmers of palm kernels were getting 56% of the world price from the marketing board, cocoa farmers 48%, and coffee farmers 49%. By the time Stevens left office in 1985, resigning to allow his hand-picked successor, Joseph Momo, to become president, these numbers were 37, 19, and 27%, respectively. As pitiful as this might sound, it was better than what the farmers were getting during Stevens's reign, which had often been as low as 10%. That is, 90% of the income of the farmers was extracted by Stevens' government, and not to provide public services such as roads or education, but to enrich himself and his cronies and to buy political support. As part of their indirect rule, the British had also stipulated that the office of the paramount chief would be held for life. To be eligible to be a chief, one had to be a member of a recognized ruling house. The identity of the ruling houses in a chieftaincy developed over time, but it was essentially based on the lineage of the kings in a particular area, and of the elite families who signed treaties with the British in the late 19th century. Chiefs were elected, but not democratically. A body called the Tribal Authority, whose members were lesser village chiefs, or were appointed by paramount chiefs, village chiefs, or the British authorities, decided who would become the paramount chief. One might have imagined that this colonial institution would also have been abolished, or at least reformed after independence, but just like the marketing board, it was not, and continued unchanged. Today, paramount chiefs are still in charge of collecting taxes. It is no longer a hut tax, but its close descendant, a poll tax. In 2005, the tribal authority in Sandor elected a new paramount chief. Only candidates from the Fasuluku ruling house, which is the only ruling house, could stand. The victor was Sheku Fasuluku, King Suluku's great-great-grandson. The behavior of the marketing boards and the traditional systems of land ownership go a long way to explain why agricultural productivity is so low in Sierra Leone and much of sub-Saharan Africa. The political scientist Robert Bates set out in the 1980s to understand why agriculture was so unproductive in Africa, even though according to textbook economics, this ought to have been the most dynamic economic sector. He realized that this had nothing to do with geography or the sorts of factors discussed in Chapter 2 that have been claimed to make agricultural productivity intrinsically low. Rather, it was simply because the pricing policies of the marketing boards removed any incentives for the farmers to invest, use fertilizers, or preserve the soil.